Welcome to the Sunshine Economy on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. It takes only about 4 seconds. That's how long it takes to announce you're running for president. Sure, there's the fundraising, the filing of legal papers, the fundraising, the hiring of campaign staff, the fundraising, the campaign website, the fundraising, the social media strategy, the fundraising, the candidate stance on all the issues, and of course, the fundraising. Sometimes the candidates introduce themselves, others don't need an introduction at all. Sometimes the announcement comes in a slick campaign online video. Oftentimes it's in front of a crowd of friendly supporters. So far, 14 people from the two major political parties have made that short declaration that they are running for President of the United States of America.
I am announcing.
I am putting myself forward.
I'm running for President.
I announce my candidacy.
I'm Carly Fiorina.
I'm Ben Carson.
I am a candidate.
I am proud to announce my candidacy.
That I am running for.
I declare that I am a candidate.
This morning I announce I am a candidate for the Republican nomination.
I'm Lindsey Graham and I'm running.
Today I'm formally entering the race for the Democratic nomination.
Today I am running.
I am running for president.
Since late March, 14 people have stepped up and stepped into the 2016 presidential race. Former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton announced her candidacy actually twice, most recently over the past weekend. Former Florida Governor Jeb Bush becomes the 15th major party candidate today. Now, they will spend a lot of time in Iowa and New Hampshire and South Carolina thanks to the early contests in those states. A few of them may drop out by the time Florida's presidential primary rolls around on March 15th. But Florida is among the biggest bounties and among the most fierce battlegrounds in the race to the White House. The last two elections that did not have a president running for re-election, in 2000 and in 2008, the margin of victory in Florida for the winner, less than 3%. The fight for Florida has been close and could continue to be as the state has gotten a lot more diverse and larger. The last time a candidate won the White House without winning Florida was 1992. Florida back then went for President George H.W. Bush. His son, of course, is the most recent Republican to announce his presidential ambitions this year.
Sean Spicer is the Chief Strategist and Communications Director of the Republican National Committee, and he joins us today from the RNC's offices in Washington, D.C. Sean, welcome to the Sunshine Economy in Miami. Nice to talk to you.
Thanks for having me.
So, does a Republican have to carry Florida in 2016 in order to win the Oval Office?
I think it's mathematically possible to not do it, but I think realistically there's no way that you can win the presidency without going through Florida.
And Florida is likely to be more competitive than ever with the four Floridian candidates, arguably, with former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee in the Panhandle, of course, Dr. Ben Carson in West Palm Beach, and Senator Rubio and former Governor Bush. How does that play into the Republican strategy for the candidates during the primary season up until March 15th here in Florida?
I think you're going to see a lot of activity in Florida, as you usually have. I mean, Florida's always been a very important state for both parties. In 2008, it was one that, they got into a huge penalty squabble on the Democratic side in terms of trying to make some deal about not campaigning in states would go early, and they still did anyway. And I think that really is a testament to the importance of Florida voters.
And to that point, how do the other Republican candidates, from the RNC's perspective, approach Florida with two big-ticket names on the primary ticket and two others additionally in Florida?
Well, I think that's actually a really good question, because I think that there's a couple things at play. One is, when you look at where Florida stands in the calendar, which is March 1st, I think you want to constantly continue to go there because you don't know who's going to be in and who's not going to be in come March 1st of next year. So it's a smart bet regardless. Number two, everyone who's running on both sides assumes they'll be the nominee. And as we were alluding to a second ago, Florida is definitely going to be one of the top three or four states that people need to be in for a general election. So I think that long-term-wise, it's very important. And then the third thing is pretty obvious, which is Florida on both sides is a pretty big donor state. There's a lot of supporters, a lot of money that both parties and all these candidates get. And so I think you're going to constantly continue to see voters in and out of Florida. I mean, excuse me, candidates in and out of Florida.
In the meantime, voters continue to come into Florida as the population continues to increase,
gotcha.
Both with in-migration from the United States as well as immigration. Let's talk about some issues here with Sean Spicer, the chief strategist and communications director with the Republican National Committee. Your RNC committee received a report after the 2012 election, which, of course, President Obama won and won here in Florida, talking about Republicans losing the popular vote in five of the last six presidential elections in states in which candidates used to win, including Florida. How does the GOP change that trend?
Well, look, I think a couple things. One is we did lose Florida. It was not by that much. And I think that what that means is that we've got to be in Florida and active earlier. And that's something that Chairman Reince Priebus, our chairman, has made as a commitment in that report that you alluded to. It means we don't just show up in Florida, you know, 90, 100 days out from an election. We've now had, since 2012, permanent ground game in Florida, doing field work, organizing, registering voters. And then in particular note of doing a lot of that in Hispanic communities, both in the I-4 corridor and then down in the, you know, Miami-Dade area.
Yeah, you mentioned the Hispanic vote and obviously the focus on Florida. Difficult not to focus on Florida with former Governor Bush and Senator Rubio running, two Floridians. But on the Hispanic vote, Governor Romney received 27% of the Hispanic vote in 2012. Former President George W. Bush received 44%. That same report called that an historic high. Do you anticipate, in order to get Florida, in order to get the Oval Office, that the Republican candidate in 2016 is going to have to trump that 44% Hispanic vote support nationally?
You know, I don't know that it has to be that, but it's got to be a heck of a lot better than 27. I think it's got to be a minimum in the mid-30s.
How much of that comes from Florida?
Well, again, I think it depends on, as we get down the path, what other states are in play, looking to get over 200, as we look to sort of create that equation to get us over 270. But there's, I think we're going to be extremely competitive in Florida. I think we're going to devote a lot of resources in Florida. So I wouldn't worry about, I mean, if I were a Floridian,
mm-hmm.
you're going to see a lot of candidates and a lot of time, folks to spend down there.
A lot of campaign advertising, I imagine, is what that means.
Yeah.
On all of our screens, right?
I was going to say, or on your air, I think that people, you know, whether it's radio, TV, or more and more on the digital side, you're going to see a lot more attempts for people, for candidates to reach out.
Yeah, talk a little bit about that strategy, Sean. You're an architect of that as the chief strategist for the Republican National Committee. That same autopsy after the 2012 election cycle talked about a digital strategy and engaging more digitally, in part to engage a younger audience, younger supporters for the Republican slate of candidates. You're partisan in this candidacy so far, but not necessarily picking a candidate within the Republican Party. On that digital strategy, how are you going to roll that out in Florida, and how could that potentially be different from the from a digital strategy from the Republicans elsewhere in the country?
Well, I mean, we've had a robust digital strategy in place since 2012, and it's constantly out there trying to interact with different voters, and then bring new folks into the fold. So it's not something that we're going to turn on or off. It's been on for a while now. And
you're going to turn it on more, though, presumably, and you have...
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, as you continue to get... also what it is, to be honest with you, I mean, more of it is that as more and more people tune into the election and start engaging more, it sort of ramps itself up.
Yeah.
As you continue to engage, I mean, there's a lot of things that, you know, we're out there pushing, if you will, trying to get people engaged. But, you know, not everyone's completely focused on the election, if you can believe it or not.
Surprising to say here from South Florida, given the two sons that South Florida is putting on the Republican ballot. Presumably that's going to continue ahead of March 15th. Let's talk debates. I know that there's been a lot of debate about the Republican debates, but you have identified
right.
Florida as a location for Republican debates right before the March 15th primary, not only here in Florida, but also in Illinois. I guess, logistically, Sean, how many candidates do you expect to be on that stage come early March in Florida for that debate?
I have no idea. and to be honest with you, I'm not that concerned. I think everyone's really, the first two are ones that where the real focus was. By the time we get to Florida, and if you look over the course of history in both parties, that's really not something that is a major concern.
We've heard from the pre-campaign messaging from former Governor Bush. We expect to hear from former Governor Bush today a positive messaging that's very common early on in a campaign. This also was an area that your autopsy of the 2012 election cycle identified in terms of the Republican messaging staying positive. How long can you hold true to that? And how much of that messaging, that positivity messaging that you'd like to accomplish is up to the RNC?
Well, I mean, that's a good question. I mean, we don't control what people say or comes out of their mouths. I mean,
the campaigns.
Their campaigns, if candidate chooses to say something. But I think when you look, generally speaking, at the, and more importantly, I think what that was talking about was, is which we were end up circular firing, shooting at our own. So I think that what you've seen up until now is very positive. I think our guys are focused on talking about the vision for America, talking about what they're for, and we'll continue to see how it goes. But I feel really good about where it stands right now.
Sean Spicer is one of the many architects, the chief architect, is chief strategist and communications director at the Republican National Committee, joining us from the RNC's offices in Washington, D.C. Sean, thanks so much for joining us and speaking with us today.
I appreciate you having me. Thank you very much.
We've got plenty more to come here on the Sunshine Economy. We hear from the Floridian leading the Democratic National Committee and her party's plans for the Sunshine Economy.
You know, it's important when you're campaigning in Florida to focus on making sure that you understand that we have an economy that thrives when everyone has an opportunity to succeed.
We're back on the Sunshine Economy, presidential politics and the Sunshine Economy. I'm Tom Hudson. Florida voters have not elected a Democratic governor this century, but a majority have supported President Obama twice in 2008 and 2012. Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz represents parts of Broward and northern Miami-Dade counties in the U.S. House of Representatives. She's also the chairwoman of the Democratic National Committee. We spoke to her earlier this morning.
Florida is always ground zero for both parties in every presidential election. We're the state that the most significant state that is a swing state that decides who is elected president of the United States. So drawing a contrast and demonstrating the clear advantage that a candidate that runs as a Democrat has compared to a Republican is really critical. And I think at the end of the day, when voters look at whoever we nominate versus who the Republicans nominate, they'll see that our nominee will be fighting for the middle class, fighting for middle-class economics, trying to help make sure that everybody has an opportunity to succeed. And like the entire pack of Republicans on the other side of the aisle, especially Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio, the Republicans fight for the wealthiest, most fortunate Americans and trickle-down economics, which you know has been tried and failed repeatedly, and that no one wants to go back to except Republicans.
You mentioned the two big Republican candidates from the state of Florida. Does that give the GOP an advantage in the battle for the Sunshine State in the primary session into the general session?
No, not at all. As a matter of fact, I'm looking forward, as are many of the people who suffered under Jeb Bush's reign as governor, at pointing out the harm that Jeb Bush did to Florida. I mean, his slash and burn policies when it came to cutting taxes for the wealthiest few and cutting dramatically spending that would have made sure that people who began struggling after the Great Recession began would have had an opportunity to have that impact blunted. Jeb Bush left us weaker than we needed to be when we entered the Great Recession, and his my way or the highway politics was divisive, and shows he certainly isn't right for the presidency of the United States of America.
The Florida economy did grow considerably under his tenure, two terms as a Republican governor from 1999 to 2007. About 1.5 million Floridians got jobs that essentially kept pace with the workforce growth at that same time period.
But what Jeb Bush did to our tax base by slashing taxes for the wealthiest, most fortunate Americans left us in a situation where we were really not able to have the revenue available that was necessary to balance our budget and to avoid significant cuts when the Great Recession hit. He also repeatedly insisted on policies that were focused on changing the education system so that we completely revamped the way we test students. It is wildly unpopular today because teachers are forced to teach to the test. Students are only able to demonstrate one way in which they can show proficiency. And that was really Jeb Bush was the author, the father of that system. And it's going to come home to roost.
Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz, you're a veteran of Democratic politics, a veteran of Florida politics. A number of your Democratic colleagues vying for your party's nomination for the White House are relatively novices when it comes to Florida politics. What kind of Democratic National Committee guidance are you giving them as they come to Florida and battle for those Democratic hearts and minds in the primary and the general voters during the campaign as it heats up on into 2016?
Well, our candidates that are running for president of the United States on the Democratic side have a wide range of experience when it comes to Florida. Certainly Hillary Clinton has tremendous experience when it comes to campaigning in Florida, both for herself and for President Clinton. Others will be introducing themselves for the first time. But, it's important when you're campaigning in Florida to focus on making sure that you understand that we have an economy that thrives when everyone has an opportunity to succeed, when we can invest in a good, solid, high-quality education from preschool all the way up to graduate school, when we can make sure that there are focuses economically on small business investment and creating opportunities for small businesses to thrive and investing in range of economic drivers that will allow us to not be so dependent on one particular sector over another. Unfortunately, the Republican candidates like Marco Rubio and Jeb Bush really have never grasped that. They've only focused on the trickle-down, take care of the people who are really doing well, and hopefully the crumbs will fall on the rest of us. And then when it comes to our immigrant population, the Democrats all support comprehensive immigration reform, and, the Republicans are all over the map. Almost all of them oppose comprehensive immigration reform, and Marco Rubio himself authored a comprehensive immigration reform bill that as soon as there was the slightest bit of pressure placed on him, he folded like the house of cards. And, the last time I checked, the presidency has a little bit of pressure associated with it. So how is he going to handle the presidency if he couldn't even handle a little pressure from his own right wing?
You certainly mentioned economics. You mentioned education earlier and immigration. Another hot button issue has been health care. And the healthcare situation in Florida has been interesting. Florida in 2008 and 2012 voted for President Obama, of course, lent his name to the Affordable Care Act, a.k.a. Obamacare. But yet the Florida legislature is still firmly in control of Republicans. And in this last campaign cycle, Florida voters, South Florida voters included, sent a number of Republicans back to Tallahassee, which have blocked the expansion of the Affordable Care Act. So as a national leading Democrat, Congresswoman, and the leader of the Democratic National Committee and the strategy for 2016, how do you square those two things for Democrats vying for that Oval Office position?
Well, certainly Floridians have demonstrated how they overwhelmingly support the Affordable Care Act. We have the most sign-ups in the federal marketplace of any state in the country, and 16 million people across the country have benefited and now have health care coverage. We also have the lowest rate of increase in health care costs in 50 years, and yet Jeb Bush needs to be able to be held accountable for what he said about the Affordable Care Act. He's actually said that it isn't working. Well, I'm not sure what Jeb Bush's definition of working is, or the Florida legislature for that matter. We could insure another million people, and we are leaving $50 million on the table because the legislature, held by Republicans and supported by Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio and the entire Republican field, won't allow Medicaid expansion so that people who have the opportunity to get some assistance to pay for health care coverage could do so. Right now, all Florida taxpayers are on the hook and paying for those people's health care because what they do is they'll continue to show up at the emergency room when they're sick. Someone's going to pay for their health care. The federal government under the Affordable Care Act will pay 100% for their health care, yet the Florida legislature won't take a good deal when it's staring them in the face and are callously turning their back on a million Floridians. It's unacceptable. And Jeb Bush, as he announces for president today, should be held accountable for that.
This is the federal contribution picking up 100% of Medicaid expansion for the first few years, and then it will be reduced down to about 90% by the year 2020. Let me ask you about the strategy here in the weeks and months ahead. What's the strategy to engage in Florida, and how has it changed from the year 2000 and 2004, years where Republicans carry the state?
Well, actually, in 2000, the Democratic candidates carried the state. The presidency was decided by the United States Supreme Court, but Al Gore actually won Florida.
The electoral votes, though, went to the Republican candidate.
Right, but the actual voters, when the votes were cast,
the popular vote went one way, but the electoral vote, which is of course is the vote that gets the candidate into the office, went to the Republican candidate.
My point is, it was decided by the Supreme Court, not by the people. The Democratic nominee has won Florida 5 out of the last 6 presidential elections. And the reason for that is that Florida voters want a president who understands that we have to focus on middle-class economics, as opposed to the Republican candidates who have consistently focused on the wealthiest, most fortunate Americans. And, you know, as Jeb Bush announces for president today, you know, Florida voters are quite familiar with him. They're also quite familiar with Bush economics. They had it under the George W. Bush presidency. Jeb Bush supports that economic plan, lock, stock, and barrel. You know, supported his brother's policy to privatize Social Security. So I am confident that when both parties have their nominees, that the Democratic nominee will carry Florida once again, because Floridians want to make sure that they have a president who has their back.
South Florida Congresswoman and head of the Democratic National Committee, Debbie Wasserman Schultz. Still to come, immigration, education, and the economy, all that matters to South Florida voters. This is the Sunshine Economy, presidential politics in the Sunshine Economy here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. Through the first half of the 20th century, Florida, like the rest of the South, was reliably Democratic. Republicans began making gains after World War II, and by the mid-1990s, people increasingly began registering as independents here in the Sunshine State. And that's a trend that's really continued as Florida's population has continued expanding thanks to Americans moving south and immigrants moving north. Tim Padgett is WLRN's America's editor, joining us here on the Sunshine Economy. Tim, how has this immigration, both domestic and foreign immigration, affected Florida's politics?
Well, in the past decade, it's made it a little less Republican in the sense that you've had, as you pointed out, a lot of immigrants coming in from the northern part of the country, settling in places like the I-4 corridor, and they are largely independent voters. They have really swelled the ranks of independents in this state to more than a fifth of the electorate. What you've then had coming from Latin America, for example, it's less of a Cuban cohort and more of a South American, Central American cohort that's also made the state a little more Democratic in that sense.
And it's something that we're certainly sensitive to here in South Florida. The Hispanic vote is not some monolith Hispanic vote, certainly here in South Florida.
Once was. In the past, the Latino vote in Florida meant Cuban, mm-hmm. and that meant Cuban Republican.
And arguably that helped deliver the state to George H.W.
Right.
Bush back in 1992, even though it didn't deliver enough for him to win the presidency.
Right,
that year.
But that has changed. In the past decade, the Latino vote in Florida is no longer monolithically Cuban. It is, as I said, become much more Puerto Rican, South American, and even Central American to a certain degree. And we saw that change in 2008 when Obama became the first northern president since FDR to win Florida. And that was a largely, he got a big push from Latinos, and especially in 2012 when even Cuban voters, half of them might have even voted for Obama.
And clearly, we have a really engaging and interesting dynamic setting up here in Florida. We've talked about, you know, obviously the four Florida-based Republican candidates, Huckabee in the Panhandle, Dr. Carson in West Palm Beach, but of course Senator Rubio and Governor Bush occupying a lot of interest here. They both, in their various offices, have received a lot of Hispanic support at the polling places. Is it the same Hispanic support?
Yes and no. I think if we go...
That's a politician's answer, Tim.
Well, this is what happens when you spend as many years as I have covering politicians. Sort of a Stockholm syndrome.
Sure.
But let's take this a step ahead. If we go to the general election, I think Jeb has much broader Hispanic appeal to Hispanic voters than Marco Rubio does. But that's not the immediate question. The immediate question is who would win amongst Latino voters in Florida, the primary here. And, you know, in 2010 in the Senate race, Marco Rubio won about 55% of the Latino vote in Florida. That makes sense when you consider that Cubans are still a majority of Latino voters here. But what people forget is that in 98 and 2002 gubernatorial races here, Jeb Bush scored 60% of the Latino vote, which again shows that even in Florida, he has a broader appeal to Latino voters beyond Cubans.
And presumably during those earlier gubernatorial races, the Hispanic vote in Florida was more concentrated Cuban than it was in 2010 during Marco Rubio's Senate campaign.
Right. So the primary dynamic really comes down to, okay, we've got Jeb, we've got Rubio. They'll probably split the Cuban vote. The question then becomes, who then picks up the remainder of the Florida Latino GOP vote? And I think, again, Jeb probably has that advantage.
And is that enough to swing a primary candidacy one way or the other come mid-March?
Yes, when you consider that about 11 to 12% of the entire Florida electorate is Latino, yes, that's a sizable swing vote.
We're talking about the horse race aspect here. It comes down to policies. Immigration is a key one, and there are some significant differences even within the Republicans on immigration. And the RNC, the Republican National Committee, has identified immigration as an area that they need a moderate tone on, especially after the losses that the Republicans suffered in 2012.
Right. And this is, again, where I think Jeb has some advantage over Rubio in Florida. It used to be that Latinos, because it was so overwhelmingly Cuban, didn't really care that much about immigration. Over the past decade, however, the Latino vote has taken in groups that do care about immigration. And this is where Jeb has shown, you know, to be a lot more, you know, policy compassionate, whereas Rubio, I think, amongst Latinos is seen as being a little bit too much pandering in recent years to the Tea Party. The other three big issues that Latinos care about, and especially in Florida, jobs, healthcare, education.
Yeah.
Education especially is where Jeb is going to have the advantage over Rubio.
Clearly, it was a policy that he marked his governor's tenure on.
Exactly.
It's a policy that he's concentrated since he left the governor's office. And, of course, arguably those issues are what all voters, of course, care about around this time. Tim Padgett, our America's editor here at WLRN on the changing nature of the South Florida vote as we're talking presidential politics here on the Sunshine Economy. Stay close. We've got plenty more to come, including playing host to presidential candidates and connecting with some voters, especially young voters here in the Sunshine State.
We need to build citizens, not just a career or a certificate, but build citizens who understand the importance of voting, the understanding of participating in the community.
We're back on the Sunshine Economy here on WLRN. It's presidential politics in the Sunshine Economy. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. Nothing is taken for granted during a presidential announcement. Some candidates go back to their hometowns. Others use an open-air rally. A favorite backdrop is education. Texas Senator Ted Cruz announced his campaign in March at Liberty University in Virginia. Former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee went to the University of Arkansas Community College in his hometown of Hope, Arkansas. It's worth pointing out that for the past 5 years, Governor Huckabee has been a Florida resident living in the Panhandle. He's one of the four Florida-based candidates. Ben Carson is another. The two candidates calling Miami home also have used education as a setting to officially launch their presidential efforts. Both Senator Marco Rubio and former Governor Jeb Bush placed their announcements at Miami-Dade College. Senator Rubio's kickoff in April used the college's Freedom Tower as its platform. Governor Bush takes his announcement to the suburbs at the college's Kendall campus. For Eduardo Padron, they're the latest in a long and growing list of world leaders and those who want to be a world leader visiting the school's seven campuses. Padron is the president of Miami-Dade College.
We feel very honored and privileged at Miami-Dade College to have the opportunity for our students to see history in the making. I think that's very important. It doesn't get any better than that. When these people come here, they can touch the people and the real future and vision of America.
That future and vision is increasingly diverse, both ethnically and economically. It's an attractive environment for any political hopeful. The staging includes the nation's largest community college with more than 160,000 students hailing from over 100 countries, 70% Hispanic, almost 20% Black. Most students are part-time, and the majority of students are women. For candidates, the school serves as a proxy for the promise of education and the possibility of America. It's a backdrop for a speech, but it becomes a metaphor for bigger policy debates. With its international student body, it's immigration, like Senator Rubio at the Freedom Tower, which the school took over in 2005. As a community college, it's economic opportunity and access to education. And Padron is comfortable with Miami-Dade College playing that role.
With these people, everybody has my cell number. It's not a secret. And they have the number of the staff here. They know who to call and what to do. And it's just a phone call and then follow-up meetings, logistics, organization, and then you have the activity and everybody seems to be happy at the end of every event. And it is something that makes us feel very proud that this institution, who's not an elitist institution by any means, is not a so-called Ivy League institution, but it's a real institution that is doing, it's changing the lives of so many thousands and thousands of people, is so respected and is able to attract, the leaders of the world. I think it's my job and responsibility to provide my students every opportunity to come in touch with the real world. And I did not lobby any of these the latest appearances.
The optics are important in modern day politics. And with Senator Rubio at the Freedom Tower sending a certain message about his personal story, certainly, as the son of Cuban immigrants. Governor Bush arguably sending a certain message by going to a suburban community college campus. Are you concerned at all about Miami-Dade College and its brand being used for political purposes with these kinds of large, very public, national, if not international, announcements?
I'm not concerned at all. We do not make political statements. We don't endorse the candidates. In no way their appearances here, whether they are Democrats or Republicans, in any way denotes our affiliations or anything like that. This institution is here to educate, and these are events, even though they are political, that provide the students with an opportunity to get educated and to be able to come in touch, as I said before, with the real people that are making history.
As the rest of the world watches Governor Bush, as the rest of the country and world watch Senator Rubio from a platform at a Miami-Dade College, what is that message, do you think, that's being perhaps subtly communicated through those campaign appearances at a publicly funded community college, the largest community college in the United States?
Well, I think the message is an important message for the role that education plays in the very competitive world of the globalized society. And I think the fact that they both chose an educational institution like Miami-Dade College give me some hope that these candidates, again, those who have come and those who I'm sure will come in the month ahead, understand that education is important to people, that the fight to make education affordable and accessible, it's just beginning, and that by them identifying with that, I think they're sending a message that is very well thought out.
Florida is going to play another important role in this 2016 presidential cycle for multiple reasons, one being the size of the state, being the third most populous state. Obviously, a number of electoral votes are at risk. I imagine Miami-Dade College is going to be on the itinerary for a number of presidential candidates.
Well, I think the best tour that I can give them is the opportunity to come face-to-face with the students that we serve. When they meet our students, when they see and learn about their hopes and aspirations, when they know the students make all kind of sacrifices in order to come to this institution, the fact that they work and go to school, that they are trying to, protect their families, to learn and to be able to fulfill both the responsibilities and obligations of being an American, that is powerful. To me, more than showing buildings and computer rooms and things like that, most institutions have that, and we're very proud of what we have here. But nothing like getting close to the students, especially, and learning about their aspirations. That's very important.
The opportunity that Miami-Dade College presents a presidential campaign is an opportunity to engage in a young voter. However, when we look at voting demographics, we have seen in the last presidential cycle, younger voters turning off to national politics, not showing up to vote. It's an opportunity, certainly, for these candidates in another new cycle, but it's also a challenge come November.
You are absolutely right. It's a national challenge. But we have done everything possible at this institution to have our students engage in the political process. And we inspire them to get engaged in the community, not just in politics, but in every aspect of the community. I think we need to build citizens, not just a career or a certificate, but build citizens who understand the importance of voting, the understanding of participating in the community.
Certainly a voter responsibility message that you're delivering there. What about from the perspective of the campaigns? Without being political, you are able to connect this institution with young people in Miami, a very diverse, both geographically, ethnically, racially diverse population. What can the campaigns learn about Miami-Dade College's success in connecting with that population locally?
Well, I think the key to our success at this college is the fact that we have created a culture of success and a sense of belonging. Many of the problems that we have with young people today is they feel disenfranchised. They feel they don't belong into typical traditional institutions. At Miami-Dade College, we have been very successful in giving students a sense of participation, a sense of belonging, a sense of ownership.
Modern institutions, would you include modern politics into that list of institutions young people feel disenfranchised from?
Absolutely. It's amazing. It's something that can be changed and need to be changed. And I think the more the candidates, the more politicians, elected officials know from people at the ground level how they feel about these things, the better prepared they will be to lead our nation.
The president of Miami-Dade College, Eduardo Padron. He wouldn't say if the college has been contacted by other presidential campaigns, but he does say he expects to play host to other candidates in the months ahead. Still to come on our program, is having so many candidates call Florida home good for business?
Florida is what's known as an ATM state. It's a place where people go to raise money. They're going to be relying on those Florida donors to do well in places like Iowa and New Hampshire and South Carolina well before you get to Florida.
We're back on the Sunshine Economy here on WLRN, Presidential Politics in the Sunshine Economy. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. And then there were four. With Jeb Bush's presidential campaign officially underway today, there are four Floridians running for the Oval Office, all Republicans.
former Governor Bush, Senator Marco Rubio, former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee, who relocated to the Panhandle a few years ago, and Dr. Ben Carson from West Palm Beach. So is that good for business in Florida with such a high concentration of Floridians in the race? Here's Matt Laszlo.
Remember the excitement back in April when Florida Senator Marco Rubio officially hopped in the race at Freedom Tower?
Grounded by the lessons of our history, but inspired by the promise of our future, I announce my candidacy for President of the United States.
And today we get the long-awaited announcement from former Governor Jeb Bush at Miami-Dade College in Kendall. Florida Senior Senator Bill Nelson is a Democrat, but he's glad those two Republicans are garnering so much attention for the state. Politics aside, he says having two candidates from the state is a win-win.
It'll be good for the Republican primary in Florida. Among the Republican primary voters, it'll create a showdown at OK Corral.
The benefits may not stop there. South Florida Republican Congressman Carlos Curbelo is predicting it will have a positive impact on the economy.
Minor boost, you know, we'll get people traveling to Florida for meetings, and the media will certainly spend a lot of time there. So it's a net gain, net positive, a little more traffic too, you know.
That may be the conventional wisdom, but experts see it differently. Bill Allison follows campaign spending and candidates like a hawk for the Washington watchdog group, the Sunlight Foundation. He's got some bad news for conventional wisdom.
Florida is what's known as an ATM state. It's a place where people go to raise money.
That's right. Allison says if anything, Rubio and Bush will be pulling money out of Florida to send to early voting states.
You know, in some ways it may be a net loss for Florida, that because they're going to be relying on those Florida donors to do well in places like Iowa and New Hampshire and South Carolina well before you get to Florida.
Bleak assessment, right? But wait, there's a little good news. Allison says roughly 60 to 70% of campaign spending goes for ads, and then a little, and he means a little, gets sprinkled locally.
And then the last thing they'll pay money for is, you know, actual, you know, gas and renting vans and trying to get people to the polls and, you know, buses and things like that.
And in this presidential primary, Florida has agreed to play by the rules of the two national parties and sit in the middle of the pack. That means 21 states will have held their contests before Florida voters get to cast ballots. Carly Urban is an economics professor at Montana State University who has studied the economics of politics. She says there's a chance Florida won't even matter this time around, or that Bush or Rubio will have packed up their Miami offices by then.
So that's another kind of takeaway for Florida. Even though they're in March, we've seen primary nominations be clinched by March. And one of the Floridian candidates might be out by then.
But what if Florida really does matter in the GOP primary and millions of dollars are spent on ads across the state? Even so, Urban says that could lock out local businesses in key markets.
The other thing that we've found in more recent work that we've been looking at is with this advertising data, we can see that more political ads drives up the price of advertising, so then you see less advertisements from like your local car dealership, and you see auto advertisements fall quite a bit. So that's the biggest category, but really all other advertisements are being crowded out.
But as Rubio and Bush crisscross the U.S., they're likely to describe Florida's gorgeous beaches and national parks, right? So maybe people will book a ticket to the Sunshine State. Not going to happen, according to political professor Ken Goldstein of the University of San Francisco.
Yeah, no, so I see zero impact on tourism. Zero. Zero impact. Right? I mean, you know, it's not like hundreds of thousands of campaign workers are going to be flowing in to Florida for the Florida primary.
And again, if the GOP race is really tight by the time Florida voters get a weigh in, Goldstein says it still isn't going to make local business owners rich.
It's not the Super Bowl, right? It's not the Super Bowl coming to Miami, which crowds out people who would have gone to Miami. You don't have 100,000 outside fans coming in for an election.
But Goldstein says he doesn't see any negative impact.
Politics may crowd out some advertisers on television. Politics is not crowding out anybody hanging out in South Beach or getting a burger anywhere.
The sad thing for Florida is this would all be different if it were, say, Maryland or Oklahoma, which never really matter in presidential politics. But Goldstein says the old adage still fits. Two is always better than one.
Sure, instead of having one campaign headquarters, you have two campaign headquarters. So maybe you have a little bit more money and a couple more folks coming to live down in Florida during a campaign.
And hey, there's always a bright side. Goldstein says the general election is where the state will receive the most money, even if that means an annoying amount of dirty ads on your television screen.
No matter who the Republican nominee is, the Republican nominee has to compete in Florida. Florida is going to get a tremendous amount of ad dollars, as it got in the 2012 election, the 2008 election, the 2004 election, and the 2000 election.
I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
Florida has a troubled reputation with presidential politics. Some of it, okay, a lot of it, is of our own doing. Some of it, too, may simply stem from Florida's image as a magnet for scoundrels of every stripe. Sure, it's easy to criticize our sometimes astonishing carelessness when it comes to the voting process itself. The hanging chads of Palm Beach County in the 2000 presidential election ignited as serious a constitutional crisis as the country has experienced in modern times. More recently, just 3 years ago, thousands of people stood in long lines after the scheduled closing time of polling places to vote. Some did not get to cast their ballots until the early morning hours of the day after Election Day, hours after the winners had been declared and concession speeches delivered. But Florida's difficult reputation for presidents stretches further back into last century. In Bayfront Park in February 1933, FDR's presidential reign almost ended before it even began. 3 weeks before his inauguration, President-elect Roosevelt stopped in Miami for a quick speech as he wrapped up a fishing vacation. An unemployed bricklayer aimed his .32-caliber revolver in FDR's direction and fired five rounds. Roosevelt was not hit, but five others were, including then-Chicago Mayor Anton Cermak, who was killed. Presidents are like a lot of Americans. They like to come here for the sun and sand. During President Truman's two terms in office, he spent 175 days, almost 6 months in all, on working vacations in Key West. President-elect Kennedy is said to have finished working on his inauguration speech at the family's home in Palm Beach with legislative aide Ted Sorensen. This is the speech that includes,
"Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country."
And, of course, the Watergate scandal had a Miami connection. Four of the five burglars were from Miami. But that did not deter President Nixon from retreats on Key Biscayne during and after his presidency. Only Nixon would hit the beach in his wingtips. He wasn't just a visitor, though. He was a Florida real estate investor with interests on ultra-exclusive Fisher Island. These days, Nixon's name also evokes a boating party hotspot, thanks to a sandbar off Key Biscayne that bears his name. In presidential politics, where optics are as important as policy, it's probably an apt name, considering the dangers that lurk in Florida just under an attractive and inviting surface. Wanda Miles is our technical director. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening.
Shucks. Don't you worry about the Day Glow Orange Life Preserver. It won't save you. It won't save you. Swim for the shores just as fast as you are able.